You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Well, James brings, he kind of brings us back into, if you can remember what he's been talking about, if you're here with us last week in chapter 3, past few weeks, he's kind of been bringing up these different issues along the way that he must have been getting reports back. He must have been hearing about this young church, a lot of issues that they were having. They weren't doing things. They were really self-righteous. There were all sorts of things going on. Well, that whole mixture has kind of been thrown into a pot. Now it's producing this really disgusting soup, right? None of the different ingredients are working together. In other words, these people were arguing with each other. They were fighting. They were warring amongst one another. And so James brings us here in chapter 4, the beginning, by explaining this conflict. We read in verse 1, where do the conflicts and where do the quarrels among you come from? And so right off the bat, he's pointing out this issue. This word here for conflict literally means in Greek war. This war amongst the people in the church. And quarrels, this is like a war on a smaller level. So it's used to describe battlefields or a single battle even. And so he's using these two terms intentionally to describe the church as a whole was experiencing war, and then there were many individual battles along the way. And he says among you, which is important, I think. It's something we could gloss over. We could be led to think just by reading this first part of verse 1 that there were problems coming from the outside, which I'm sure there were and there would be to come. But here James is specifically referencing quarrels and fighting going on amongst the people within the body of Christ, within the church, among you. And that kind of puts things into perspective for us. I think a lot of times, if we're interested in what the Bible has to say, if we want to learn how the early church grew to become the church that is today, we can tend to romanticize the early church and think, wow, we just need to get things back to the way they were then. Well, look at how they were then, just like they are today. These were people just like you and I. They weren't anything special, nothing different. These were folks that were trying to follow God on some level, at least some of them, and they were butting heads with one another. And so the Bible's honest about this point. James may have been the earliest letter that we have in the New Testament, meaning it was one of the first, if not the first letter. So we're going back here in time to right at the very beginnings of the church in the first century. And so here we're kind of, he's exposing some of the problems, some of the stains, the blemishes here that the church was warring with each other. And so the conflict has kind of been set up for us by James, and now he's going to start getting into the causes, or some of you could think of this as the symptoms. And oftentimes, I think we're persuaded to, like I was saying earlier, to suppose that a lot of the causes of conflict can come from outside sources, especially if we are the person or one of the people involved in the conflict. It's easy to look outside of ourselves and think, well, it's their fault, or it's this issue, or maybe it's supernatural, so maybe it's satanic, the enemy could be at work, or it's because of these other folks who are doing the wrong thing, and so on. And the list continues. All of the causes start adding up, and they all involve these things exterior to ourselves. And yet what James is going to point out here is something a little bit different. He says, don't they come from your own desires that battle within you? And so James takes that idea of all of these external things flying in our face, trying to pull us away from God or to block us from doing the thing that we think is right. And he says, wait a second. Okay, there may be things on the outside that are influencing you, that are causing problems. But there's also a big problem within you. Something within your heart. Something within your own self. And he describes it as desires here. This word for desires in Greek is the word hedone, which is where we get the English word hedonism from. It can be translated as pleasures or excitements or things that we, or may entertain us. Don't they come from your own desires, these things within our own hearts? And so we could picture a map of battle plans, right? And got the enemy maybe in the center of the map. And then you have the forces that are coming to strike against the enemy from all different directions. You have something over here, another contingent of the army coming from this side. Other the Marines are going to come in over here. The Air Force will come over this direction. And so you have all of these different things. Well, okay, that's fine. That's well and good. But let's picture that in terms of the enemy being our own, or these different desires, these different symptoms, being within our own heart, within our own selves. And so there may be things that are affecting us, or desires that we have, that we want this, or we long for this other thing. James is describing all of these things as like they're different enemies within ourselves that are striking at our heart, or that are striking at our faith in some way. And so rather than it being just external things, we've got this own battle raging within us. David Roper comments on this section of James. He says, James swings his axe at the root of the problem, a smothering absorption with ourselves, getting what we want when we want it. Frustrated in the pursuit of our own well-being, we resort to rage and cruel force. He says conflict stems from desire, James says. A Greek word from which we get our word hedonism, taken to its extreme, it's the restless and ruthless pursuit of personal pleasure without regard for others. We're all capable of this. We're all capable of amassing these things where it doesn't matter. We want this. We're going to go this direction, the other thing. Even if it's at the expense of somebody else, we place ourselves at the center. He continues. He says, there's nothing wrong with desiring pleasure or seeking it. Pleasures become dangerous only when they are snatched in the wrong way or at the wrong time. It is the stealing of a watermelon that's wrong, not the enjoyment of eating it. And so what he's getting at here is, okay, it's not that God doesn't want us to enjoy ourselves. It's not that he doesn't want us to experience pleasure in life. It's that when we're going about these things in the wrong way, we create our own battle plans to accomplish what we desire, when in reality what it's doing is just furthering the war. It's expanding the conflict. It's making everything worse. Cicero, back at the middle of the first century BC, the famous Roman statesman, says, it is insatiable desires which overturn not only individual men, but whole families, and which even bring down the state. From desires there spring hatred, schisms, discords, seditions, and wars. So here is a Roman statesman, a Roman politician, commenting on something that the Bible is very clear on. He's noticing this too. He had no knowledge of what the Bible has to say. He's noticing it as well. Or his contemporary, Philo. Is it not because of desire that relations are broken, natural goodwill changed into desperate enmity, that great and populous countries are desolated by domestic dissensions, land and sea filled with ever new disasters, by naval battles and land campaigns? For wars, famous in tragedy, have all flowed from one source, desire for money or glory or pleasure. Over these things, the human race goes mad. Yeah. Think about how we mark history, how we consider periods in human history, different eras. They're divided, they're identified by the battles that were fought, by wars that went on, by pursuit for glory and treasures, for power. Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, James says, you desire and you do not have. You murder and envy and you cannot obtain. You quarrel and fight. You do not have because you do not ask. And so now he's kind of getting down into some of the more nitty-gritty symptoms here. Some of the different elements that all make up this cause for which we can in time become more and more estranged from God. Look at what he says here. He says, you cannot obtain. You do not have. Well, that sure is the truth, right? How many of us here are able to produce everything that we need? How many of us here have everything that we ever desired, everything that we ever wanted? Nobody. None of us are totally self-sufficient. We all are dependent on something, even if it's just the natural resources that our bodies require. You cannot obtain, you cannot have. to recognize this right here. So a moment of honest self-reflection is able to admit that this is our position before God. Every one of us, we don't have everything that we need. We're not fully satisfied in the ways that we desire. And when we're honest with ourselves about our position here, we are in a spot to be able to look outside of ourselves. And what James is pointing out here is that God should be the source. He should be the direction that we're looking at. It's not just that we're seeing things in a horizontal plane where we're just looking around to take things, because that's like a never-ending battle. We're just constantly looking to take, trying to find ways to fill ourselves up, looking for ways to bring pleasure or satisfaction into our lives. James is trying to point out that that's never going to fulfill you. That's never going to actually satisfy what your needs are. There needs to be a vertical perspective here. There needs to be an ability to be able to look and see what God has to offer. And when we're honest with ourselves and honest before God, we recognize, yeah, our position before God is helpless, utterly, totally helpless. And that's where God's able to come in, when we've kind of sacrificed our own egos. We've set aside our own will, our own predetermined plans, and said, okay, God, maybe I don't have this right. Maybe you do have something for me. Where he's able to come in and do his work in our lives. And he says, you do not have because you do not ask. You know, think about how many funny stories there are in our friends' lives, our own lives, about the predicament somebody got in because they refused to ask for help. You know, they refused to ask for directions, or they refused to, you know, whatever the case is. This happens all the time. Unwillingness to ask for help. And this is kind of getting at the root of what we were just talking about. An unwillingness to recognize our need. And James is kind of, you know, putting his fingers, pressing into the nerve here to try and remind his readers, yeah, you do not have because you do not ask. In other words, you are helpless and you need outside assistance. You need God in your life. God has something for you. He can take care of this wound. He can take care of this need. And so that brings us to the course then. So if the causes are our position of neediness and our situation, maybe there's fighting, there's some sort of conflict in our life. Now he's going to go on to describe this a little further. Look at some of these things that James brought up here in verse 2. These different areas, these different issues, or like I said earlier, you could think of them as symptoms. Symptoms of a problem where for somebody who just is not self-sufficient. Somebody who doesn't have everything, who's not in a perfect position. Desire, murder, envy, quarrel, fighting, do not ask. These are all different things that are kind of pointing to this problem. And the people that James was writing to, he must have been hearing, these were things that were going on in that church at the time. And so he brings up desire here. This was used earlier back in verse 1 to describe that kind of seeking after pleasure. And so if we think about a battle map, and like I was describing in our analogy, this could be like a picture of what's going on in our own heart. In different directions, we have these different things that are coming in, and oh, it's pulling us this way, or this is something that's affecting us now. Today, I'm really sad. Tomorrow, everything's going to be all right. And then, you know, we get to tomorrow, and it's not, and there's something else comes up. And so it's like from every direction within our own hearts, within our own lives, we can be affected in these ways. Check out what Romans 1 says. So God abandoned them to whatever shameful things their hearts desired. In other words, we're in a position before God where he's not going to force our hand. He's not going to make us follow him or listen to him or receive his help, for that matter. If we're unwilling to admit our neediness or our helplessness before God, he says, okay, go right ahead. And then our own heart's desires are the thing leading and guiding us, which is a pretty scary spot to be in. Or in Romans 6, therefore do not let sin reign in your mortal body so that you obey its desires. Here, Paul is equating sin, our rebellion against God, our violation of who God is, to obeying our own desires, our own direction, our own plan apart from God, something that James is going to go on to illustrate even further next week, later on. Okay, so Watchman Nee is a famous church planner, Christian writer and leader, teacher, beginning of the last century. He comments on this. He says, of course we must use the world because we need it. But let us not want it. Let us not desire it. Would God urge us to watch and pray where they're not a spiritual force to guard against? So the problem that confronts us these days is not how to refrain from buying and selling, from eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage. The problem now is to avoid the power behind these things. For we dare not let that desire triumph over us. You see what he's getting at here? He's pointing out that our own desires, our own will, our own plans, behind those things can be something that's actually drawing us away from God. And the Bible describes this world as a system of values that are specifically designed to target desires that we have, to draw us away from God, to take us off course, to kind of pollute our thinking and our mind and our hearts so that we can't actually find what God really has to offer. We go off on rabbit trails all the time thinking that, oh, this is the thing that's going to work out, or this is the other issue that's going to save, you know, my life and it's going to fix all my problems. And then we get there or we don't and we still have the problems. What the Bible's trying to point out is there's something more that we desire. There's a vacuum or a hole in our heart that only God can fill. And he goes on, he says, you and I must be perfectly willing to part with anything at any moment. It matters not whether I leave $2,000 or merely two. What matters is whether I can leave whatever I have without a twinge of regret. Are the things that we amass, the things that we are accomplishments, whether it's physical or whether it's some sort of social prestige, is that the thing in your heart, in your life that you feel like, yeah, that's the thing that's going to make me fulfilled. That's the thing that's going to satisfy whatever desire I have in this regard. And what Nia is pointing out is those things won't matter because in the end, whether we leave behind a bunch of degrees, whether we leave behind a bunch of money, a bunch of stuff, it's meaningless. We're going to be gone. He says, I hold myself in the will of God, and I'm not afraid to give if God asks me to give. I keep nothing because I love it, but I let it go without regret when the call comes to leave it behind. That is what it means to be freed from desire. This ability to leave the things, to set the stuff aside, these concerns of the world, it's another term that the Bible used to describe this value, these other values that are opposed to God, or that can take the place of God. To leave those behind and be willing to just come to God with nothing to offer, right? We have empty hands before the perfect, self-sufficient, all-knowing, all-powerful God. What can we possibly offer him? Our good works? Useless. What is he going to do with that? He's not asking for you to clean up your act. He's not asking for you to do this thing or do the other thing. Show me how faithful you really are. God is saying, I want you to come to me humbly and accept what I'm offering you, and then allow me to work in your life in such a way that you can humbly receive these kinds of things from me in perpetuity. James 1:14, we read this at the beginning of our study of James, but each one is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desires. Then when desire conceives, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is full grown, it gives birth to death. So James clearly had this as an object that he was going to try and focus more on in his letter, because he begins the letter by bringing this very point up. The idea of desire away from God, our own desires enticed by that. And the way he describes it is it's like a trap. It's like a snare. We're going for this thing and we get trapped by it, and eventually what it will do is draw us away from God. It will cause us to violate God and who he is, and eventually can bring about spiritual death. Well, he says it's the second piece here in verse 2, after mentioning desire, murder. Murder. Well, we don't know if there was a murder actually going on in the church. I don't think it's necessary to understand this as it being physical murder necessarily. Because at the very least, James would have had on the forefront of his mind Jesus' teaching on murder. For example, we read in Matthew 5, Jesus says, you have heard that it was said to an older generation, do not murder. Whoever murders will be subjected to judgment. See, Jesus is reminding them of one of the Ten Commandments. He says, but I say to you that anyone who is angry with a brother will be subjected to judgment. And so Jesus is kind of showing, he's raising the bar to its rightful place for what violating God's will really is. we think to ourselves and we pat ourselves on the back and we raise ourselves up. Well, I'm not as bad as Hitler. I'm not as bad as this murderer. And Jesus is like, yeah, okay, well, you didn't, you know, murder 6 million people. Yeah, but you hate a lot of people. You get angry at people and you lose your temper. And in your heart, you self-righteously judge people thinking that you're better than him. Yeah. Jesus is saying that's just like murder going on in your own heart. And so as we would look at things from an external kind of outside of the cup perspective, again, Jesus is pointing us back to the inside of the cup, what's going on within our own hearts. There's the battlefield. That's the battleground right there. Or in 1 John, John tells us everyone who hates his fellow Christian is a murderer. I mean, he just lays it right out. He says it as clearly as possible. Hating other people, being bitter, unwillingness to forgive. To God, he's saying that's akin to murder. Yeah, you may not be physically, you know, driving a stake through their heart or running them over or all the other ways you can murder somebody. We could list many. He says, no, you're hating somebody. You hate that person. Boy, this changes our outlook on what God sees as sinful, doesn't it? It's not so much just the outward actions all of a sudden. It's the things going on within my own head, within my own heart. Yeah, I've probably murdered quite a few people under this definition. Quite a few. In brutal ways. Envy. So desire, murder, envy. Yeah, envy, to be envious, jealous. This is describing that kind of comparison mentality. Oh, I'm better than she is. Well, she didn't get the attention from them. Or he's not, you know, as good looking as I am, and so on. Envious, jealousy. Yeah, 1 Corinthians 13. This is the chapter on biblical love. Paul illustrates for us, love is patient, love is kind. It is not envious. To be envious, to be jealous of somebody else, to be stuck in that kind of comparison loop is not loving. The two things are incompatible. They'll never reach. They'll never meet. To love and yet to remain envious or jealous means that you cannot love. You cannot love somebody if you're jealous of them. Here's a good example of this. In Acts 7, Stephen is talking about a bunch of Old Testament events, and he mentions here in verse 9, the patriarchs, because they were jealous of Joseph, sold him into slavery. And so he's reminding the religious leaders of his day that the jealousy of one of the patriarchs, the founding fathers of the Jewish faith, the children of Isaac, of Jacob, rather. Okay, they were so jealous of their brother Joseph that they sold him into slavery to the Egyptians. Could you imagine the level of just kind of bitter hatred that would require you to take your own brother or sister and to sell them into slavery? We think, no, there's no way. I would never do that. That's crazy. Well, these guys, you wouldn't really say, oh, these are really bad dudes. They did it. They were so jealous, so envious, because Joseph was supposedly the favorite of the father. He was given nice things. Yeah, jealousy drove them to do something like this to their own brother. Quarreling. So here he's using the similar terminology again. This time he's, okay, quarreling in this sense is just referring to battles. You battle with people, could be with roommates, it could be with family members. Could be with your spouse. This constantly looking to make sure that your perspective is right, that you're the one that's heard, that you're putting yourself forward as the authority in this issue. Unwillingness to compromise, unwillingness to work through the issues, the battles that go on with people in our lives, the fighting. So here again is a similar word, but it's also used to describe warfare. And so it can be on a small level, it could be on a larger level. Sometimes people can, you know, you can be in fights with everyone in all of your roommates in your house. I'm the one that's right and they're all wrong. Or it could be you against your whole family. Right? Usually the small battles don't end there. They tend to multiply. And so eventually, you know, may start with arguing with one person, and before you know it, it's been transferred on, and you're kind of viewing yourself as the lone ranger. You're the one that's fighting against everybody else. And this is just kind of an evil, wicked spot to be in, where you're just always fighting. You're always having to make sure that whatever you think is the right way, unwillingness to work with others. And then the last one he gives here in verse 2, you do not ask. So we mentioned this before, the problems of not asking for help. In this sense, though, we have to remind ourselves what James is really talking about. You do not have because you do not ask. Ask who? He's talking about asking God. He's talking about prayer. In other words, we can become so self-conceited, so absorbed in our own ego, that we're not even praying to God. You do not ask. You do not pray to God. And this is a major symptom of somebody who's stuck in this kind of loop, where they're unwilling, their prayer time with God has basically disappeared, either because they don't believe that God can answer their requests or because they think they've got it all figured out on their own. One of the natural courses of ego and the kind of self perspective, the selfish lifestyle, is to see a dramatic drop in our prayer life. As a follower of Jesus, to not be talking to God, to not be in regular communication with him throughout the day, it just seems to be, do we really believe that God is who he says he is? That he's all powerful and that we're in a spot where we need his help? Do we really believe that? We have to ask ourselves those questions. If our prayer life is struggling, why is it that we're not asking? Why is it that we're not turning to God? Well, maybe some of these other symptoms, some of these other things James has been mentioning here could be present in our lives. Maybe there is some comparison. There's some jealousy going on. Maybe our desires are reaching out in every possible direction to try and fill something that's vacant in our own heart that only God can fill. Maybe that is the case. Why is it that we're in a spot where we feel like we can't turn to God? We do not ask. He says in verse 3, you ask and you do not receive. Because you ask wrongly, so you can spend it on your passions. Because you ask wrongly. Many translations read, because you ask with wrong motives. It's interesting. I think that is what James is implying. In the Greek, the word motives is absent. It's not there. It's implied by the translator. But I think that's probably pretty accurate. The asking wrongly, this literally reads, you don't receive because you ask badly. And so, what does that mean? What does it mean by badly or wrongly? How do we ask wrongly in our prayer? Well, it might have something to do with this. It might have something to do with the thing that we're asking for isn't the right thing at all. We're asking for selfish reasons. We have a motivation within our own heart just to get something that we want. And you can imagine what prayers like this would be like. Praying that God gives you something so the other person doesn't get it. Or praying that you get acknowledged for this thing makes you look better. That kind of internal motivation to spend it on your passions. I think another illustrative word here is this word spend. To spend it. You know, the idea of spending is, you know, contrast with saving. And so to spend something, it's like, I'm going to spend everything I got on this as though once you do that, it's gone. Right? I'm going to spend all my money on this thing or everything I've got here. Well, the problem with that mentality is that it exposes this kind of ill-placed motivation or this misunderstood prayer. To think that a follower of God could run out of something that God supplies to us is a misunderstanding of who God is. He doesn't run out of resources. He's unlimited. You can't ask him too much for something. Oh, I've already answered that prayer. That's, you know, you only get 3 wishes. It doesn't work like that with God. Here's what Zane Hodges has to say on this. He says, by using the word spend, James clearly implies that the benefits they sought from God would soon be used up. They would have no permanent or lasting worth. Coupled with the word spend here, the word passions, suggests transient gratifications of the wrong kind. No wonder they don't receive answers to the requests of this type. To think that you're just, you know, oh, well, I want this thing. God, I'm praying that you can, you know, give me this material possession or give me a bunch of money. I pray that I win the lottery, whatever. You know, it's like, what's the direction of a prayer like that? What is that really getting at? If we're being honest, we admit it's for self. It's for self. You know, it's not that God doesn't want to answer our prayers. It's not that we have to have some sort of special formula. We read, for example, in John 16, Jesus points out, until now you have not asked for anything in my name. Ask and you will receive it, so that your joy may be complete. Now, this isn't like a name it and claim it kind of thing. You know, oh yeah, this is what I want, and God's going to give it to me. That's not what he's getting at here. We see a little bit more clarity here from in John's letter. He says, whatever we ask, we receive from him because we keep his commandments and do the things that are pleasing to him. This is the confidence that we can have before him, that whatever we ask according to his will, he hears us. And so there is a caveat. There's an addendum here, according to his will. To not ask, to not, you know, turn to God in prayer, to ask something outside of his will would be exactly what James is describing. To ask for with selfish motives so that we can spend it on our own pleasures, our own passions, our own self. Well, we read in verse 4, James is really pulling out the big guns. He says, adulterers, you do not know that friendship with the world means hostility towards God? So whoever decides to be the world's friend makes himself God's enemy. He's not holding back any punches at this point. He calls them adulterers. Adulterers. Okay, so this is a theme that we see throughout the Bible. There's an entire Old Testament book devoted to this concept of spiritual adultery, the book of Hosea. And then it comes up many times in the New Testament as well. This idea of adultery. Let's think about what this looks like, adultery. Okay, adultery is something in a relationship, okay, with your spouse, somebody that goes out on their spouse. Okay, this is an either-or proposition, right? Committing adultery is not like you just commit a little bit, right? I'm just going to take a little slice of adultery here. I'm not going to eat the whole pie. No. Just a little bit is adultery, right? That's the whole thing. And so it's either you commit adultery or you don't. And it's very black and white in that sense, and God uses it the same way, right? He's saying either you're going to follow me and you're going to take what I have to offer you, or you're not. And repeatedly, Jesus uses this same kind of language. We see this throughout the New Testament. It's friendship with the world is hostility towards God. You cannot serve both God and wealth. You'll hate the one and love the other, right? And again, this kind of language, it's either or. With adultery, okay, it's not something that just happens overnight. Someone, you know, a spouse in a marriage doesn't wake up and say, I'm going to commit adultery today. I hadn't thought of that before, but now I'm going to do it. It's not how it works. It takes time, right? It's little small compromises along the way. It may take years of time before it actually manifests in adultery, but it's little decisions over time. Well, in James's usage of the term, he's describing it the same way. Small compromises over time. Instead of agreeing with God in this way, I'm going to do this other thing, right? It may not be that big of a deal. It could be a little thing here, a little thing there. Over time, those things add up until eventually our hearts have just completely been closed off to God, and we're no longer hearing from him. We're no longer interested in that. Breaking a promise, yeah. When you are married to your spouse, you promise. It's a pledge, right? The whole act of marriage is committing yourself to that person. No one who gets married is planning for divorce, right? No one who gets married is planning to do something like this. It's something that usually happens later. And what it is breaking that promise that was made. Taking the pledge that you've saying it's worthless, burning it up, throwing it away. Well, God is using it the same way. Well, what promise? It's that he's made a promise with us for eternal life. He's made a promise with us to take care of our needs. We say, yeah, God, I want that. I want what you have to offer. And then a couple years go by, we throw it away. Say, no, I don't want that. You know, I'm not interested in taking what you have to offer me. Now, we're not talking about losing our salvation here. We're talking about walking away from this kind of relationship, right? In the similar sense that you'd see in a marriage. transfers affections. Adultery is a transfer of affections. It's your affection should be poured out on your spouse. Should be in your spiritual relationship with God. It should be poured out on God, your love for God. But instead, what happens is no longer is it that God is the thing that's receiving my affection, my care, my thought, my attention. Instead, I'm giving it to my job, my school, my savings account, the things that I'm collecting. That other person that, you know, is really hot to me, and yeah, they're going to get all my affection. Whatever it may be, you know, just fill in the blank. Something, a transfer of affection from God to something else. Focus on emotional stimuli. Yeah, adultery. One of the reasons why it's attractive is because it's kind of, you know, it's like, yeah, this is exciting. It's thrilling. It's secret. It's whatever. It's different than what I had before. Well, why would you get into a position like to follow after our emotions, to seek after that just pure emotional stimulation? That is so fleeting. That's so transitory. That lasts for moments and it's gone. And usually regret comes right in and fills that space afterwards. It's a skewed memory that twists the truth. Yeah, in a marriage situation, you know, it's like forgetting, you know, the reason why you married that person to begin with. Forgetting why you said you loved that person, why you cared for them. Those, all of those great times that you had together, all those deep moments together, easily forgotten, easily thrown away. Instead, usually what's focused on in these situations is, well, they wronged me here, they don't show me attention there. And it's just only remembering these negative things. Well, the same thing can happen with God. I didn't get what I wanted from you, God. Or my life isn't going the way I wanted it. And it's like we've completely forgotten, we've erased from our own memory what God did for us in the beginning. What our relationship was like when we came to know him. His incredible act of grace and his mercy in our life. The fact that through and against every means, he came and reached us. He used these people in my life that loved me and cared for me. And we just, it's like all of those things are forgotten. Well, it used to be great. Short-lived, this is a short-lived thing. It doesn't last long. It's in an adultery situation, those kinds of relationships usually fizzle out pretty quickly. It's not like you found the new love of the rest of your life. Oftentimes, somebody else comes along and the same process repeats itself all over again. And the same thing can happen with God. We think, oh, this other thing, oh, that's going to satisfy. That's going to be what I want. And it's short-lived. It's transient. And then we have to find something else. And it's also, it's a refusal to see ourselves as the problem. Isn't that the case? It's always their fault. They're the ones who wronged me that led me to do this thing. I hate that I had to do this, but I had no choice in the matter. It's their fault. It's the bitter, jealous, angry, vengeful kind of vindictive mentality that totally corrupts and spoils us. Any refusal to admit our part in the problem, that I played any, had anything to do with this, I'm the pure victim in this situation. I think that if we were being honest, we could probably identify some ways that we contributed to a problem. Maybe not in all ways, and yes, we may have been hurt. There may be very objective, very clear reasons why we feel the way that we do. But when it comes to God, it's never he's never the one that's causing the problem. With another person, that could be the case. But with God, we have a perfect, all-loving God. And so often we just think that we point the finger right at him. Chuck Swindoll says, why does he call some of his readers adulteresses? Because they were cheating on God. Their attention, affection, and allegiance are not towards God and his people, but towards themselves and the world. A transferring of affection. Yeah, that's exactly right. He says, whoever decides to be the world's friend makes himself God's enemy. Like I said, James is just kind of laying it right out there. He's telling the truth as it is. We read in 1 John chapter 2, the world is passing away and all with all of its desires, but the person who does the will of God remains forever. This is the perfect example of the transitory nature of this world, of the things passing away and its desires. That thing that we desire, we long for so much that's opposed to God, will eventually pass away. It won't be there anymore. It won't matter. He says in verse 5, or do you think that Scripture means nothing when it says the Spirit that God caused to live within us has an envious yearning? This is a very difficult passage to translate. James seems to be, from my study into this, it seems as though what James is drawing on is kind of like an overwhelming picture of what the Scriptures teach. This idea that within us, on the one hand, it could be our own spirit, our own human spirit, has an envious yearning to go and find something else to try and fill it with that's not God. Or it could be the Holy Spirit that God places within everyone who receives Christ, who has a righteous jealousy of things that try to take God's place in our own hearts. Either way, whichever James meant by this, it's still this replacing God with something else in our lives. And that's really what he's getting at here. And so that brings us to his cure. There's a story about a man who was on a train with two old ladies. He sits down in the car and the old ladies are bickering and fighting with one another. And the one old lady's like, "Well, sir, you need to help us figure this out, because she wants to sit by the window. This is your seat by the window. But if she sits by the window, she's going to open up the window and I'm going to get freezing cold and I'm going to catch pneumonia and I'm going to die." And the other woman's like, no, that's not what I'm saying. This woman here, she sits in your seat by the window. Well, then she's going to keep the window closed and I'm going to get heat stroke and I'm going to die in here." And so they go back and forth and the guy can't figure out what to do about it. So he says, "Okay, listen, ladies, calm down. Why don't I call the conductor of the train? Have him come back and settle this matter for us." "Okay, fine." The conductor comes back a couple minutes later and says, "Okay, he hears the problem out. He hears both their perspectives." And then they both stop talking for a second to hear what he's going to say. He's going to judge the situation. So he says, "Okay, this is what the plan's going to be. In order to make peace in this situation, we're going to open the window so that the woman who catches pneumonia will die. And then we'll close the window so the woman who's going to get heat stroke, she'll die. And then we'll have peace. I don't have to hear all this complaining anymore." And the man says, "Oh, okay, that sounds pretty good." The conductor leaves and the train moves on. That's one way to solve a problem, right? That's one way to bring about peace and conflict. Well, just eliminate everybody who bothers you. God, on the other hand, has a different plan, right? His plan for peace involves, you know, working on and within our own hearts. He says in verse 6, but he gives greater grace. Therefore, it says, God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. So he's quoting from, it's either from the Psalms or the Proverbs, could be both of them. It comes up in both places. Either way, he's pointing out this greater grace. So we may think that we've got the right desire. We've got the right move. This is what I want, God. He says, no. He's got the greater grace. He has something even better than what our wildest dreams could imagine. We may think we have the perfect solution to our problem. God says, I've got something even better. Are you willing to hear me out on it? A greater grace. And so the first solution that James gives us here to this kind of conflict is to focus on the grace of God. Both how it applies to us and how it applies to the other individual or other people. God's grace. The fact that we don't deserve anything from God except judgment. And what he's decided to give us instead is his son on the cross paying for our sin. The grace of God, the greatest gift conceivable. The focus and aim and direction of Scripture, the purpose of Jesus' life, God's great plan to save all people. It just requires us laying down our pride long enough to ask for what he has to offer, the grace of God. He gives a greater grace, greater than anything we could come up with on our own. He says, so submit to God, but resist the devil, and he will flee from you. So there is an external enemy, right? He comes up pretty frequently, actually. But here in the second solution to the problem, he mentions resist. Right, so there's a submission to God, to his grace, of course. But in this case, if there is an outside influencer here, you've got the enemy, the devil. Solution to resist him. Resist him. This is taking a stance of refusal to compromise. And if you can think about that adultery analogy that James used earlier, this is a refusal to compromise on your pledge, on your promises, a refusal to give in to anything else, to look for anything else to fulfill your need. I'm going to trust God. I don't feel, things aren't going that great for me right now. I feel like I'm missing something. I'm not going to go this other direction. I'm going to trust that God's going to come through and that he will hear my prayer. He may answer it on his timing, but I'm going to resist the urge to try and find satisfaction somewhere else. He says, draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and make your hearts pure, you double-minded. So the third solution he gives here for us is draw near to God. Draw near to God. This involves our time in our prayer, time turning and sitting under God's word, surrounding ourselves with the people of God, drawing near to God. Oftentimes what you find with somebody who's uninterested in seeking the kind of compromise and resolution that God offers in the midst of conflict, in the midst of suffering, someone who's unwilling, the last thing they do is draw near to God. They're drawing near to everything else, and it's never solving the problem. Draw near to God is our third solution. He says, cleanse your hands, make your hearts pure. Here, I think what James is trying to get at is this idea. The Bible uses the term repentance, or agreeing with God, turning the other way, willing to admit to God, my hands are dirty. I've got a problem here. My heart is impure. Allowing and agreeing with God so that he can change that, so he can take care of you. Rather than seeking some other way or denying it or coming up with any sort of justification. And so our third solution is to turn away from that thing, whatever it is that's drawing us away, and instead turn towards God. This idea of doing a 180 and going right back to God. I agree with you, God. What I did was wrong. 1 Corinthians 10:13 is pretty comforting in this regard. We read that he will not let you be tried beyond what you're able to bear. But with the trial, he will also provide a way out so that you will be able to endure it. So in the midst of temptation, in the midst of that desire that's drawing us away from God, God's standing right there. We can be assured from God's promise that he's right there saying, here's your way out. You don't have to go this way. You don't have to go down that road. I'm right here and I'm giving you a way out. He says, humble yourselves before the Lord and he will exalt you. And so here is our last solution. Shouldn't be number one. Should be, what, number four or five? Humility. Humility before the Lord. If we think we've got everything that we need on our own and we have no need for God, then God is going to be of little use to you. He's waiting for you to get to the point where you say that you need him. And that's when he can come into our life and take care of us. Humility. And that's exactly what Jesus exhibited at the cross. He could have done anything he wanted, but instead he humbled himself by coming obedient even to the point of death for our sake. Well, let's draw some final thoughts here on these first 10 verses of James 4. Here's some questions to ask yourself. In conflict, are you able to admit your fault? Or is it always the other person? Is it always a justification? Is it always something else, somebody else's fault, someone else's problem? Or are you able to say, yeah, I played a role here. I'm not without sin. Yeah, there's some issues here in my life as well. Whose desires are more important to you? Yours or God's? If you're somebody who's like, well, I care what God desires for my life. I want to follow after Jesus. Okay, that's great. That's the first step. Well, then practically speaking, how are you actually allowing his desires to rule your life? Are you going to him, or you don't ask and so you don't have? How are your desires lining up with his? Are you actually considering what he has to say? Are you realistic about your own shortcomings? Are you willing to admit, yeah, okay, yes, I played a part, but I'm also really weak in this area. I've got some problems. And so I'm willing, and I know I need to ask for help, whether that's from people or from God. Are you willing to put yourself aside long enough to hear what God might be saying? Setting your ego back, okay, and actually turning to him. Well, maybe he is speaking to me. Sometimes we can be so zealous for this thing that we desire that we would claim in the moment, yeah, God's not talking to me. And then we realize, wait a minute, I haven't even been quiet enough to listen. How, you know, are you willing to listen to what God might be saying in that situation? Well, that's all we have there for James 4 tonight. Yeah, what you have for us, Lord, is so much better than something we could come up with on our own. Even in our best days, our best moments, you have something so much better. And I pray that you would help us see that and trust in you to come through as you've promised. We know that you're a trustworthy God and you have a way out for us in the midst of a temptation that may draw us away from you. You always provide that, Lord. We thank you for that. We also thank you that you came through and gave us the ability to actually and fully take care of our deepest desire, which is victory over death, something that you gave us at the cross. I pray anyone here tonight who may be interested in that kind of victory and that kind of relationship with you, that they'd turn to you and they'd ask for it. And we thank you that for any moment of humility that someone might have in their heart tonight and what that means and what Christ did for us. Thank you for that, Lord, in his name. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.